This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as a world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Monday, the 30th of September. There have been loud blasts in Beirut as an Israeli ground incursion into southern Lebanon looks imminent. We get the latest from the region and assess what the consequences of such an operation could be. Also, as the Conservative Party holds an extended post-mortem at its conference in Birmingham, I've been talking about the party's past and future with its grassroots, its new intake of MPs, and its most powerful elected politician, Lord Houchin. As a stranded cruise ship leaves Belfast after a four-month delay, we speak to two passengers who used their time in dock to meet, fall in love, and get engaged. With its tanks massing on its northern border and messages being passed to allies and enemies alike, Israel has today been telegraphing its intention to launch what it calls a limited ground incursion into southern Lebanon aimed at Hezbollah. Well, tonight, as cross-border shelling continues and explosions have been heard in southern Beirut, big questions remain about the scale and scope of that operation and whether the outside world will even know that it's started. It's an operation aimed at the Lebanese militia, whose leader was killed in an Israeli airstrike on Friday, but it has one eye firmly trained on the state that stands behind it. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu sent this warning to Iran in a message in English addressed to the Iranian people.
There is nowhere in the Middle East Israel cannot reach. There's nowhere we will not go to protect our people and protect our country. With every passing moment, the regime is bringing you, the noble Persian people, closer to the abyss. The vast majority of Iranians know their regime doesn't care a whit about them.
Well, Hezbollah may have lost much of its leadership in recent days, including, of course, Hassan Nasrallah, but his deputy Naim Qassem today issued a defiant message.
We recognized that the battle may be long and all options are available to us. Should the Israelis decide to launch a ground invasion, the resistance forces are ready to engage with it.
Well, from Joe Biden, the leader of Israel's main ally, the United States, few words today, but in public at least, a sense of frustration at the path being pursued.
Just the fact that Israel may be now launching a limited operation into Lebanon. Are you aware of that? Are you comfortable with their plans?
I'm more aware than you might know, and I'm comfortable with them stopping. We should have a ceasefire now. Thank you.
The Foreign Secretary, David Lammy, has also reiterated calls for a ceasefire, but he emphasized that Britons should leave Lebanon immediately while they could.
We will do all we can to assist people to get out, and we have secured places on commercial flights that are flying tomorrow so that UK nationals can get out. I urge them to leave because the situation on the ground is fast moving. And of course, whilst we will do everything we can to protect British nationals, and those plans are in place to do so, we cannot anticipate the circumstances and the speed with which we can do that if things escalate in a major way over the coming hours and days.
Let's speak now to the BBC's Middle East correspondent, Lucy Williamson, who is on the Israel-Lebanon border. How are things looking tonight, Lucy?
I think it's fair to say there are growing signs that a wider invasion is imminent, if not indeed underway. There's been no confirmation of that from the Israeli army, but they have said they are sealing off three areas along the border towards the eastern end of the border here. We have also seen troops, tanks massing near this border, about two dozen tanks, many more armoured vehicles today, a couple of miles from the border. And tonight I can hear jets flying overhead, the sound of artillery being fired. I mean, you can imagine the swirl of rumour and unconfirmed reports, some of it coming from residents who live along this border, but it's very, very difficult to really pinpoint what exactly is happening tonight. But I think, as I say, there are growing signs of an Israeli invasion.
Meanwhile, explosions being heard in Beirut as well. And we've heard from Western leaders, calls, appeals, if you like, for a ceasefire. But do we know, if anything, what they might be saying to the Israeli leadership at the moment?
Well, you've heard Israel's allies, the US sort of forefront among them, saying that, you know, a ceasefire is the off-ramp to this situation. The conflict here has grown and grown step by step over the course of the past 10, 11 months. Really, it began as a conflict that people saw as being very carefully calibrated by both sides not to cross the red lines that might lead to full-scale war. But obviously, the situation has changed quite dramatically in the last couple of weeks, and Israel has taken much tougher offensive action inside Lebanon, assassinating key Hezbollah leaders, including Hassan Nasrallah, exploding the communications networks used by the group, the widespread airstrikes, taking out rocket launchers, it says, and now these troops and tanks massing on the border. So I think people talk a lot about the last war that happened here between Israel and Lebanon almost 20 years ago in 2006. It was seen to, you know, Hezbollah was said to have fought Israel to a standstill at that point, you know, a real wake-up call for Israel's armed forces. But when you talk to people here at the border, a lot of them say, well, look, that's as maybe, but it bought us almost 20 years of peace. And really, this is the time. Hezbollah is now so weakened that if Israel does want to really strike a blow against that group, this is a good time to do it.
Lucy, many thanks. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson there joining us from the Israel-Lebanon border. Well, let's get the Israeli view of where things stand tonight. Lieutenant Colonel Sarit Zahavi is an ex-intelligence officer, former Lieutenant Colonel in the Israeli Defence Forces. Currently, she's director of the Alma Centre, a think tank that's dedicated to studying and raising awareness of security threats on Israel's northern border. Welcome back to the programme.
Thank you.
What is your point of view? You are in northern Israel, I know. What are you seeing? Do you sense that the ground incursion has already begun?
We couldn't tell from what I see. For us, it's just another evening, the way all evenings look and heard in the past year, with the sounds of blasts coming from the north and sounds of interceptions earlier this evening. This is the experience here, the same. We hear reports in Israel, though, that the ground incursion had started in some of the areas here.
Now, you will remember what happened in 2006 very well. You were in military intelligence then. It was portrayed as something that led, in a sense, to a stalemate. Is it something that Israel is looking at now, and or Israelis looking at and seeing as a precedent in the sense that it might buy some time, or are there concerns about the losses that a ground incursion might lead to on the Israeli side?
First, of course, all of us have family members that serves in the IDF. It's compulsory service here, and many are drafted. So, of course, we are worried of losses. But at the same time, we understand that there is no other choice. In order to bring the people back home, we need to clear the areas next to the border from any presence of the military activity of Hezbollah, to make sure that they cannot raid these places and massacre the Israelis like Hamas had done, since this was their plan and they were completely prepared for it.
So do you think this is going to be a limited short-term incursion? Will that be easy to do, given that Hezbollah, despite losing its leadership, still has large numbers of fighters there? They will be well prepared. They will be dug in.
I agree. It's not going to be easy. It's not a walk in the park. And the terrain is more challenging than the terrain in Gaza. But I think that the fact that this is happening after the past 10 days is very important, because it has not only operational importance, but also on the psychological level. The fact that many of the commanders of Hezbollah were either eliminated or injured I believe, and Nasrallah himself, of course, I believe that this sends the military operatives and the terrorists of Hezbollah in a completely different situation than they were 10 days ago. The IDF was preparing for this day. I think in the past 18 years, we knew from day one that the resolution that was accepted in the previous war, in the end of the previous war, would not hold on. Hezbollah violated it from day one. And we knew that eventually it will end up like that. And I'm saying that very, very sadly, because, you know, it's the fourth time that IDF is entering into Lebanon. And it was my father who fought there and my friends, and now it's the next generation. When is this going to stop? We truly want to see different situation and different relationship with the state of Lebanon.
Well, I was going to ask, I was going to ask you, do you think even if this does bring those who've been displaced back to their homes, is it not simply a temporary solution?
It's not even a solution. It's Israel had dealt with terror throughout its existence. As long as on the other side there are people that don't accept our existence here, that's the best we can do. And we need international community here with us to at least get a better arrangement than the previous one, that it will hold on much more.
An arrangement with whom, though? With Hezbollah, with the Lebanese government?
Whoever is willing. I'm not sure the Lebanese government is enough. It's strong enough. But the problem is that the previous arrangement had no teeth. If we want to have a diplomatic arrangement in the future, we need effective monitoring force there.
Well, look, thank you very much for joining us. That was ex-intelligence officer from the IDF, Lieutenant Colonel Sarit Zahavi. Well, let's go to Beirut now, because there have been reports tonight of a large explosion in southern Beirut. We can speak to Abir Bassam, who's a journalist for Al Ahed News. It's a publication owned by Hezbollah. Good evening. Can you tell us what is the situation in the capital at the moment?
Well, now they are bombarding two important areas in Beirut, Laylaki and another area in Dahiyeh, means southern suburb of Beirut, and of course, I've just heard that Hezbollah fighters, the freedom fighters, resistance, have just attacked Israeli tanks and Israeli soldiers
inside Lebanon.
Yeah, in Ladaysa. Yeah, so, not inside Lebanon, but on the border,
right
next to Ladaysa. They have not entered South Lebanon yet.
Do you expect them to, though, in the short, in the near future?
Well, this is what Biden told us today when he said that Israel informed the U.S. about the operation, and they gave Netanyahu the green light when he gave this big speech at the Congress as a protector of the Western democracy. So he had the green light back then, and now he is executing what he promised them to do, which is protecting the Western civilization. He's protecting you, actually.
Well, what do you think that's going to mean for your country? What is it going to mean for Lebanon if the Israelis do come in on the ground in southern Lebanon?
I don't know. Maybe 20 years of resistance. We go back to the same cycle. And Netanyahu could have ended the war if he had accepted to stop bombarding Gaza and killing civilians. And now he is in Lebanon killing civilians with bunker busters.
He is also, of course, killing the leadership of Hezbollah. It is a much weakened movement, though, now, isn't it?
No.
And this, no?
No, it's not. No, it's not.
Despite the losses, despite the pagers and the walkie-talkies blowing up and dozens of people being killed and others injured?
No, dozens of people being killed, yes. Not only dozens. Yesterday, There were 45 casualties, not casualties, martyrs who died, I mean, dead people, and 70 wounded in Ain al-Dilba in Saida.
So
we don't know. We don't know why these people were killed.
So
okay?
you talked about 20 years of resistance. I mean, in the short term, what can Israeli troops, if they do enter, as expected, southern Lebanon in the next maybe few hours, what can they expect?
Of a high resistance, just like what you have seen or witnessed in 2006, for sure, Yani. And now, by the way, the areas which they are bombarding in Al-Dahye, Laylaki, and what's its name, Burj al-Barajne, I mean, the Israelis may be thinking about they want to invade through the sea. Because they think that Hezbollah will bombard from inside the citizens his missiles against their troops coming to Beirut, maybe, or to Tyre, or I don't know where they are coming through. I mean, this is ridiculous. Why would Hezbollah put the missiles in resident among resident people or among his his people?
Abir Bassam, we have to leave it there. And Abir Bassam there, who is speaking to me from Lebanon. She's a journalist for Al Ahed News, a publication owned by Hezbollah. And the UK government has chartered a commercial flight out of Lebanon to help British nationals who want to leave following the escalating violence in the region. That was announced by the Foreign Secretary today. British nationals and their spouse or partner and children under the age of 18 are all eligible. Now, coming up later on in the programme.
People that were starting to lose their patience, their sense of humour, and we've been able to provide a little bit of a good news. Everybody's overwhelmingly happy. Of course, they're all coming to our wedding, whether they like it or not.
As the delayed cruise ship that's been stuck in Belfast for 4 months finally sets off, it is carrying a newly engaged couple whose unexpected stay in the city led to romance. We'll be speaking to them.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as the world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, though, in every conversation, in every nook and cranny of the Birmingham International Convention Centre, four names bubble up above the conference hubbub. Robert, Tom, Kemi and James. The four leadership contenders are the story at the Conservative Party conference as the Tories seek in their latest three-word slogan to renew and rebuild after the kind of election defeat that Barack Obama once described as a shellacking. Robert Jenrick, Tom Tugendhat, Kemi Badenoch and James Cleverly have all been talking the talk, pressing the flesh and, in the case of at least one of them, making a few headlines. She, the former business secretary Kemi Badenoch, was one of the two who were sharing their vision with party members today.
What is the centre ground? You know, if we allow our opponents to occupy a particular place, the centre ground shifts. It's not about the centre ground, it's about the common ground. British people have something... have something in common with every single party. But what we want to do is make sure that we are where the majority of people are. That's often common sense, common values, common understanding, not left or right. Let's be there.
Okay. Her pitch to members in conversation followed that of Tom Tugendhat.
People didn't vote for that paddleboarder to become Prime Minister, and they didn't vote for Nigel either to become Prime Minister. They voted against us. People woke up in the morning and they wanted to get us out. And some people voted Lib Dem, some people voted Reform, most people stayed at home. We need to rebuild trust in the Conservative family and rebuild trust in British politics. And I'm standing because rebuilding trust and building trust is something that intelligence officers do every day. And offering leadership is what this country so desperately needs.
Robert Jenrick and James Cleverly will be quizzed by party members tomorrow. In a moment, we'll hear from someone being courted assiduously by all of the candidates, Lord Houchen, the Tees Valley Mayor, probably the most powerful elected Conservative in the country. First, though, I have been to the conference in Birmingham and to a nearby area which switched its political allegiance at the election to hear how grassroots and elected Tories are reflecting on their defeat.
Well, here in the main foyer, I suppose, of the conference, there's a lot of milling around, people going to and from drinks receptions and fringe meetings, and there's also been a bit of party paraphernalia on stage. At the party shop, they've been selling Margaret Thatcher Toby jugs, Winston Churchill Toby jugs, but what is really being sold here, of course, are the four candidates for party leadership. Everywhere there are banners hanging down with their faces on. Well, let's find out what some of the new intake of Conservative MPs make of where the party has gone wrong and what they want to happen.
Harriet Cross, MP for Gordon and Buchan.
Ben Obsejecty, I'm the new MP for Huntingdon. Definitely a period of self-reflection required. I mean, for us as new MPs, we've come in with a certain amount of energy and enthusiasm to be able to inject into the party. And you know, the party is a little bit down. You know, we did lose and we lost heavily. There's a lot of narrative within the media about whether we sort of tack further to the right, as people like to say, or we move to the centre. I don't think it's as simple as that. I think you have to cover both of those within the scope of conservatism. And we are a broad enough church to be able to do that.
What's your analysis then, Harriet, of what went wrong for the party more broadly?
We started to fall behind in the polls when things like Partygate were breaking. That's when the party started to lose the trust of the public. And once you start to lose trust, that's when any decision you're making after that becomes difficult. So huge amount about what we need to do is rebuild trust. And to me, I think that's actually more important than do we shift right, do we shift left, do we stay where we are?
Now, you've both, I think, gone on the record as backing different candidates. So
we're not hiding it well.
So perhaps tell us who you're backing and why.
Yeah, so I'm backing Tom Tugendhat, and the reason I'm backing Tom is he can appeal across the board and he can bring the party together.
Ben, you've made your choice. Who is it and why?
So I'm backing Kemi Badenoch. I think she is the right candidate to stand up to Starmer and face down Farage. I think what members really want is they want the ability to choose somebody who they can believe in, who they can rally behind, and who is going to set the party back on track.
Hello, Jamie. Hello.
Jamie, all right.
So we've come about half an hour or so from the conference venue, and we are in the constituency of Wolverhampton North East. This area voted Conservative in 2019, but it switched allegiance to Labour this time. We're in the Wensfield Conservative Club, and just next to the bar is a cutout of Her Late Majesty the Queen in a orange coat behind a Sir Winston Churchill. And this room is actually called the Roy Weston Lounge. It is named after the chairman of the club for the last 10 years, Roy, and he is our host today, Roy. So tell us, what went wrong, what needs to change for the Conservative Party to get back into power?
It went badly because they never told the people the truth. They were never honest with us. When we come back into power, and we will come back into power, they're saying 10 years, I'm saying 5 years.
Oh, you're a confident man.
I'm confident. Because Starmer can't carry on with what he's doing. And this Rachel Reeves, I ain't got a clue.
Well, who's going to be up against her? Who do you want to be up against her then? There's four left in the race.
Right. Ideally, and I know I can't do it, turn the clock back, I'll have Maggie Thatcher. All the while. But I think I'll go for Robin Jenrick. Yeah.
Well, look, Roy, if you wouldn't mind, you've assembled quite a good selection of people here. Maybe you can sort of introduce us and we can speak to some of your members.
Right. No, ladies, here's your chance. Don't urge him.
I'm told you the Golden Girls by this
golden
guy.
The Golden Girls.
Well, whether they are golden or platinum, these four ladies are sharing a bottle of white wine on a Sunday afternoon. And one of them is Jan. She voted for the Conservatives in 2019, but for Reform UK in July. So, what are the issues that Jan and her friends Jean, June and Georgina think the new Conservative leader needs to tackle first?
Immigration and the tax and the housing situation.
There are four people now running left in the race to be the next Conservative leader. Is there any out of them? Do you know them? Is there anyone that appeals to you?
I don't even know who they are. I mean, who are they?
new generation of young people recognise the significance and the value of conservatism.
Well, we're back at conference now, and we just popped into that session, which was essentially a post-match analysis of what went wrong in the election. And there was a lot of talk about the need to appeal to young people. So let's find out what some of the young Conservative Party members who are here want to see.
Hiya, I'm Lillian.
And how old are you, Lillian, if I can ask?
I'm 19. When you think of like Conservative issues, more about tax and all and migration and all that stuff. But what I'm really looking for is the compassionate side of conservatism.
So compassionate conservatism.
Yeah, that's what I'm looking for. Yeah.
We have another young Conservative Party member here, another 19-year-old. So perhaps you'd introduce yourself.
My name's Hugo. Where the Conservative Party will go wrong is if they choose to go down that route of making sort of aggressive statements in the media. No, don't go that way. Deliver for the people, create opportunity, and that's where you'll win.
And is that especially true for young people, do you think?
Definitely. I mean, look at all of the major parties. What are they giving to young people? Not a lot. Because there's no reason, right, that the Conservative Party shouldn't be able to win over younger voters. And it's just because they are not occupying that space of offering opportunity and a successful future to young people.
Young Conservative Hugo, though, he heard before him Lillian, they were speaking to me from the Conservative Party conference in Birmingham. Well, also there is Ben Houchen, Lord Houchen. He's the Conservative Mayor for Tees Valley. He defied dire local election results back in May to remain in his post when hundreds of Conservative councillors were booted out, as was the Conservative Mayor of the West Midlands, Andy Street. So what does Lord Houchen think went wrong for the party at the general election in July?
The country lost trust in a Conservative government and the Conservative Party. The reason for that was, I think, we demonstrated a lack of competence in government. There was certainly a feeling, it didn't feel like there were things working in the country. Felt like things had broken under the Conservative Party, certainly over the last 2 or 3 years. And all of that was exacerbated by the infighting, the deselections, the people quitting, the scandals. Obviously, the Liz Truss administration, I think we cannot underestimate just how much that cut through to ordinary people who are not interested in politics. All of those things culminated in a mass rejection of a Conservative government in favour of, frankly, anybody else.
So what next? What about turning things round? What does the Conservative Party need to do?
All of the leadership contenders are saying the right things at a high level. They're all talking about unity. They're talking about rebuilding that trust. There are significant worries within the party about how do we rebuild that economic competence that we've always been perceived to have. You know, there has always been a thing in the Conservative Party. People might not particularly like us, but at least they respect us as being a competent party of government. So they're all saying that makes perfect sense to me. They all need to get into the detail of how they're going to do that. And the very first how is how do you get a fair hearing with the public? At the moment, the public aren't interested. They don't care that there's a Conservative Party conference. They're not interested in the leadership election because they've turned off. We need to say to the public that we get how badly we got it wrong. And then hopefully over a period of months and potentially years, we start to get that hearing that allows us to get into the details of things like policy and setting out a position for the next election.
Trust, economic competence. How do you regain a reputation for that in opposition, though?
And that's the million-dollar question. And I don't sit here pretending that I have the answer. And I'm also not standing for the leadership. But what we're not hearing from the leadership contenders is a detailed response to that. And that's the big worry. And it's actually very difficult to do in opposition because you're not in charge of anything. You're not delivering services. You're not running anything. In opposition, it's often about hearts and minds. And I think we've got to reconnect with the public, understand what we did wrong, and again, help people understand what a Conservative Party stands for and how it improves their lives.
The question of illegal immigration, it's a big subject of discussion at the conference. Robert Jenrick has said he would, if Prime Minister, quit the European Convention on Human Rights as soon as possible. Others, Tom Tugendhat's talked about that being an option. He's also said he wants a legally binding cap on the number of legal migrants coming into the country at £100,000 a year. Are these areas that you broadly agree with?
It's interesting. All of the contenders are saying roughly the same thing. And Tom Tugendhat talks about derogations from the ECHR, so in effect opting out of parts of it. I've had long conversations with Robert Jenrick where he would say in his time in the Home Office, he saw practical examples of where we are not able to deport terrorists, rapists, murderers because of the protections they have under the ECHR. And his view is that we have to leave it. Now, all of them are valid views, Immigration, for me, is in effect a focal point because of the symptom of us failing to deliver. I personally think we failed, and the thing that we really got thrashed for was our economic incompetence in the last couple of years. And we can talk about things in our control and out of our control, things like COVID. People have then focused on immigration as an example of that incompetence.
Now, is it, as former Justice Secretary Robert Buckland has said at conference, is it then a rabbit hole, the reddest of red herrings, to be spending a lot of time debating whether or not to stay in the European Convention on Human Rights?
I think it sends a signal as to principle. It sends a signal as to what the Conservative Party stands for. I think it goes to the heart of things like sovereignty, which is a hangover from the Brexit debate as well. So it all has a part to play in a Conservative conference because we should be discussing these ideas. Immigration is extremely serious. If we want to get anywhere near winning the next election, people need to see us as competent as being able to grip hold of that, because people have looked at us over the last couple of years and said, well, you lost control of that.
Something that wasn't there in 2019 and was in 2024, of course, was Reform UK. Is that something that the Conservative Party needs to have at the top of its mind? Is recapturing those who went to Reform something that the leadership candidates should be focusing on?
Yes, we should absolutely be focusing on capturing those votes. My diagnosis of the problem is that it wasn't because Reform had a fantastic policy agenda platform. You know, I don't think many people who voted Reform, if arguably any, read their manifesto. The reason Reform did well is because the Conservative Party was doing terribly and did terribly in the last couple of years of government. People actually didn't feel like they cared much for a Labour government, and so there were a huge protest vote.
Yeah, it's also about communication, isn't it? Nigel Farage, whatever you think of him, is a very good political communicator.
He is, and he's very politically savvy in identifying the problems that resonate with people. I think one of the things that he has rarely done, and certainly hasn't done in his time in Reform, and he didn't do this in the election, was come up with any actual, realistic, practical solutions to the problem that he faces. Now, at the moment, that's not his job. He is an opposition party. He knows that for any chance to Reform to have more influence, he's going to remain an opposition party. And the best he can hope for is actually a resurgence, I think, in the Conservative Party in the next election, and hoping to be some sort of kingmaker. For me, it's not about Reform. It's actually not about the Lib Dems. It's about us going back to basics, re-engaging with the public. And if we can do well, people will naturally come back to us. Reform are a consequence of our failure, not because they succeeded in their own right.
You're not going to name a name, I suspect, but can you tell us what are you still looking for? You know these people well. You say they're coming to you asking for your vote as the probably the most powerful elected Conservative politician in the country. It's something of a golden endorsement to get. What is going to swing it for you?
Well, I think that's more of a demonstration of how far the Conservative Party have fallen rather than anything that I've done. What's interesting, I've spent a lot of time with all of them over the last couple of months, and they all have very positive things to offer in very different ways. They're all very different personalities. I mean, James Cleverly is an incredible communicator. He's extremely relatable. He's able to connect with members and the public in a very familiar, normal way. Robert Jenrick, I think, is arguably the most polished. He's certainly got, I would suggest, probably the most professional team around him. He's very clear on what his lines of policy and what he stands for. Kemi is a great thinker. She has some incredible ideas. I think she brings something slightly different, particularly on social issues that others aren't able to bring. And I actually think Tom Tugendhat, who I didn't know at all really before the leadership contest, is unfairly treated. I think in the Conservative Party, he's probably seen as kind of the left-wing, kind of centrist candidate. And I think that's largely down to the fact that he voted Remain in Brexit. But if you look at his policies around security, around China, the economy, I think he's raising a few eyebrows. And in a conference in particular, I think people are giving him a really interesting hearing. So it feels to me like everything is concertinaed. And the Conservative Party at the moment doesn't know what it wants out of the leadership candidates because they offer so many different things.
Do you?
I don't at the moment. I don't. I like all of them for very different reasons. And at the moment, I haven't made my mind up as to who I'm going to support. And like I say, for me, all of them need to be more honest and more open about how they're going to deliver the things that we know we need to deliver. And I think it's fair to say that none of them have done enough in setting out the how, rather than just, again, the headlines of the problem. So I'll wait and see to get a bit more meat on the bones.
That's Lord Houchin, Conservative Mayor of Tees Valley. Quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. Our main headline tonight, there is growing evidence Israel is about to send ground forces into Lebanon to attack Hezbollah with tanks massing on Israel's northern border. The BBC has concluded and published the investigation into complaints of bullying at Strictly Come Dancing. It's apologised to the actress and contestant Amanda Abingdon after she accused her dance partner on the show, Giovanni Panisse, of being unnecessary, abusive, cruel and mean during rehearsals. While the BBC says it upholds some of the complaints of verbal bullying and harassment, it doesn't uphold claims of physical aggression. Giovanni Panisse has previously strongly denied any suggestion of abusive or threatening behaviour. And in response to the report, he said he believed the majority of the false allegations have been thrown out by the review. Charlotte Moore is the BBC's chief content officer.
I do want to apologise on behalf of the BBC to Amanda, and I also want to thank her for having the courage to come forward. You know, this is not an easy thing to do, to come forward and to make a complaint, a formal complaint. I think, you know, I do want to thank her for that. I do need to be really clear that this is a confidential process, so I'm not able to go into the specifics.
Now, if you sign up for a round-the-world cruise, you've probably got a bit of time on your hands, but passengers on board the cruise ship Villa V Residence Odyssey can't have imagined they'd be making a four-month stop in Belfast because of technical problems. Well, tonight, with the repairs completed and the right stamps placed on all the right certificates, the ship is about to set sail. So how do the passengers feel?
We are so excited. We've been here almost 4 months now, so we are ready to get on the ship.
We've run all over the place. We went into the Belfast tourist thing across from City Hall, and they're like, well, what haven't you done?
We have our down days, but then we always rally together, and we're raring to go. It'll be great.
I have like three umbrellas now.
And wonderful memories, wonderful memories.
Well, two of the passengers have used their time on dry land to acquire more than brollies and memories. They've actually acquired a future spouse. Canadian Jan Peroni and American Angie Hassani met during the week spent walking between ship and shore, and they've announced they're getting married on board the ship next April. I caught up with them earlier this evening as they were standing in the Belfast cruise terminal watching the newly repaired ship come in after some last-minute delays.
We've all been on pins and needles over here trying to make sure that we were going to get on tonight. They just announced it's on the way over and expecting to be here in about another 20 to 30 minutes and we can finally embark.
And sail off into the sunset as a couple.
Exciting.
So you're going to sail off together and you'll be soon sailing off to a new married life together. So tell us about meeting and how it's been for the last couple of months.
Yeah, you know, it's actually been amazing. I think we're the only two people on the cruise ship that haven't minded the delay at all. Angie and I, neither of us are cruisers. We both met when we got here in May. And through circumstance, a little bit of traveling back and forth, finally about 2 months ago now, we started going back and forth to the ship, commuting on a daily basis, our walks. And we realized just not only what great friends we'd become, but that neither of us wanted to spend any more time apart from each other.
Did you have any idea when you started on this cruise that, I mean, maybe for you, Angie, that you would get into this kind of relationship?
No clue at all, to be honest with you. I had actually planned this trip with my sister, Lisa, and so it came as quite a surprise when I met Gian and found that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with him.
Is your sister with you?
She is not. She'll be out here in just a couple months. She's just got a couple loose ends to tie up.
The good news is her mother's with her, so I've been able to meet the mother-in-law early in our relationship.
Did you get to ask for a hand in marriage?
Yes, I did. We had a nice romantic engagement on the River Lagan last week on the 17th, a little over a week ago. It's been a bit of a whirlwind, but we're living our best lives.
I bet you are. And I suppose this is a silly question given what's happened, but is Belfast a romantic place?
It's a very romantic place.
100%.
It's gorgeous here, and the people are very friendly, and the nightlife and the architectural designs and the whole city is quite a fantastic place and definitely holds a romantic place in our heart, for sure.
And I understand that the ship captain is actually going to officiate at your wedding. Is that right?
He is.
We're going to get married between Panama and Costa Rica in the spring.
Wow. So between now and then, what? Just sailing around?
It's kind of like we're starting our honeymoon before we get married.
Yeah, it's that perpetual honeymoon we're looking forward to.
Is there any part of you that's going to be a bit sad to leave Belfast, given that it's the place you've met and fallen in love?
Yeah, I definitely, it brings a little bit of sadness to me, but it, more than anything, it's just a special place that I know we will repeatedly come back to and visit, maybe on some of our anniversaries and different things, but definitely looking forward to setting sail. But Belfast definitely holds a special, special place in my heart.
And what do the rest of the passengers make of it all? How have they been reacting?
I think everybody was looking forward to some good news, you know, with all the constant delays and you know, surprises. That, you know, there was people that were starting to lose their patience, their sense of humor, and we've been able to provide a little bit of a good news. Everybody's overwhelmingly happy. Of course, they're all coming to our wedding, whether they like it or not. So, no, everybody's smiling. And again, we're just really enjoying our time, the rest of the time we have here.
They always say that it's a test of a relationship if you can go on holiday, on vacation together. I guess for you, you've had that test straight away, haven't you?
It's like doing a house renovation, except this has been a boat renovation. And, you know, twice as much and twice as long has been a bit of an understatement here.
But I think because of the experiences we've had already early on in the relationship, it's been pretty much a time-tested success here in what we'll be able to set sail in for 15 years.
Angie Hassani, Jan Peroni, bon voyage to them. Good luck with their married life. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'm back tomorrow. But for now, from me and everyone here, good night.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's role as a world's leading superpower. The job of U.S. president is one which has great impact beyond its own borders. But Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have very different ideas about the role of the U.S. abroad. What is America's place in the world today? And how would Trump and Harris shape that role? The Global Story. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.